the Moment Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. After weeks and weekends of late-night negotiations, California's budget appears set. Governor Newsom still has not put pen to paper on it yet, but the cuts he proposed got cut, and now all that lawmakers are hoping for is a little economic good luck. Plus, LAS Studios has a brand new podcast all about Hollywood reinventing itself post-pandemic. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Ahead on the program, we'll continue our series on police reform. And today, we're going to hear from a gang intervention expert, Georgia Leap. She's the director of the Health and Social Justice Partnership at UCLA. Plus, will Disneyland reopen next month or not? I know you want to make plans. We're going to get some insight and try and straighten that one out for you coming up in just a bit. But first, it's the state budget. After two consecutive weekends and several late nights of negotiations with legislators, Governor Gavin Newsom announced a tentative deal, abandoning some of the deep cuts he was seeking midway through the pandemic. It's a compromise he stuck with California lawmakers 1 week after legislators passed a placeholder budget. All right, so what is next? John Myers is the Sacramento Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. John, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
All right, before we get into what could be in that amended deal, let's remind listeners what cuts Gavin Newsom first proposed and how lawmakers reacted to those cuts.
Well, I mean, it was a pretty tough budget. There was a total of about $14 billion in proposed cuts the governor outlined in the budget document that he presented in May. A good portion of that was to education, about $8 billion in cuts to schools, which a lot of school districts said would likely prevent them from reopening or certainly reopening in any substantive way for the new school year. Social services cuts, a number of places, health care cuts that we have seen in prior budget deficits in California. That plan landed with a thud in the legislature. In particular, Democrats in the legislature said they were not interested in cutting that much from schools. They put forward their own plan, which they approved a week ago today on June 15th, which was their constitutional deadline. And the two sides, or three sides, I guess you should say, the state Senate, state assembly, and the governor, have been haggling about it ever since.
And that constitutional deadline you mentioned, June 15th, if they didn't agree by then, they would have had their salaries cut, right?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. Voters changed those rules to say we want on-time budgets, and on-time budget was defined as the legislature, not actually the governor agreeing to it. And it took until now before we have a full deal that we think we're going to get fully voted on at the end of this week. The start of the new fiscal year for California is July 1st, the week after, so the governor's got to get his work at looking at this document, signing it, done pretty quickly.
Now, this new agreement has been outlined for the LA Times. What can you tell us about it?
I would call it a hybrid approach, and by that I mean that there are cuts being made now because the governor really outlined his $14 billion in cuts as saying they were necessary if the federal government didn't provide more coronavirus relief. The legislature wanted to give the federal government more time. We certainly know that Speaker Nancy Pelosi, President Trump, other Republicans in Congress have not provided additional relief yet. So this deal assumes no relief is coming for now. It makes about $12 billion in spending reductions. They are different than what the governor wanted, but they do not include schools. I think probably the most substantial thing that our sources have shown us in the outline of all of this is that school funding, and this gets complicated, but school funding largely will maintain where it is, but the school districts will have to front more of the money themselves. They will have to use their cash reserves. They will have to borrow money. The state will pay all of that back, but only in a few years from now. It's called spending deferrals. We did them during the recession. They're not popular among school officials, but they are better than a straight cut, which would have been a lot worse.
So just to be clear, right off the bat, schools will have to come up with the money themselves, and the state ideally gives that money back or somehow winds that money back to them.
Yeah, it's basically a delayed payment system of some of the money that is owed to schools. It is not all of the money by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, schools are still going to get a lot of that money up front, but it makes their funding more complicated. And we've heard a lot of school districts have been struggling financially as it is. So it remains to be seen how they're going to deal with this. But if there's any good news for schools, it's that it's not an actual straight cut of school spending. I think they're going to see that as a victory. Again, this is the way you balance books in bad years in Sacramento, and this is how it looks like we're going to do it this time.
I was wondering if there was any like projection of how this new hybrid budget approach might affect schools.
It's too early. We haven't even seen the actual document. I've talked to a lot of budget sources, and that's why we have a story online now on the LATimes.com website. But we've got to see the full details. We also have to see the full details of what the other spending reductions are. We know that there are a lot of cost of living allowances in state programs that are not being given. And I should point out another place where there's a lot of money that was cut out of this budget from what we've been told, and that's in state worker pay. $2.9 billion in cuts, furloughs of a couple of days a month for a lot of state workers. So there are a lot of details we have yet to see, both on the schools and additional cuts and other ways that they balance the books.
Talking to John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Any programs that are doing okay or stand to benefit right now?
Again, hard to say without seeing the whole agreement. I would point out that one of the things that happens in every deficit year and every economic downturn, I should say, is that we see social safety net programs, the caseloads increase. We're talking about Medi-Cal, which is health care for the poorest Californians, CalWORKs, the state's welfare assistance program. Those are based on your income and your eligibility for that. So we will see caseload grow there. We think it's not going to grow quite as much as the governor thought it would. At least that's the assumption that's being made into this, because that costs a lot of money. But I do think some of those key social services programs, health care, human services, Democrats in the legislature were insistent could not be cut, because they pointed back during the Great Recession. That's what happened. We cut those programs, and it took a very long time for the most struggling Californians to get out of that. So I think that probably is one of the bigger protections that we have heard out of this deal that a lot of the advocates for those programs are going to be championing.
John, for better or worse, with the state slowly opening back up, how much of this is hinging on a kind of some positive economic outlooks? Say everything opens up, coronavirus tends to maybe bend a little bit that curve. I mean, are we hoping for some good luck here?
I think we're hoping for some good luck. I think, and again, when we see it, we'll know for sure. I mean, the way my assumption of this is that it is cautiously optimistic in a lot of places. It really depends on how deep this recession is, how fast the economy bounces back. There have been a lot of discussions in Sacramento of projections that would say the economy would bounce back in some way by the middle of 2021, of next year. If that's the case, that's a pretty good sign, and perhaps some of these cuts are not going to be long-term. I will tell you that the one big thing that we don't know right now is what tax revenues look like in the state. You may remember that lots of Californians did not have to pay them on April 15th. They don't have to pay until July 15th. Once we see that data next month, we're going to have an awfully good look about whether this budget will stand the test of time or whether it has to be reworked again this summer.
One more thing, John. I know we touched on it a little bit earlier. Is California just not expecting any federal help coming in the next few months, either from the Trump administration or Congress? Nothing at all in the near future?
Well, first of all, we should point out that we did get some, and local governments got some. The state got some. This deal assumes also about $5 billion in coronavirus assistance for schools, a lot of the distance learning stuff. That isn't there, and that is good news for schools. Whether we get more, I think the assumption is we will get more, but when and how much? And I think the timing is huge. This budget says that, look, if we get the if we get some of this money, some of these cuts can be reversed. Some of those IOUs to schools can be wiped off the books. But if we don't, then they're going to have to stay in place for that. So I really feel like it's an issue of timing here. And for that, we are all watching what goes on in Washington. It's really hard to know.
All right, understood. John Myers is Sacramento Bureau Chief of the LA Times. John, as always, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, it's not an understatement to say that we're living in a tumultuous time, but where there is a crisis, that means there's also an opportunity. One place where there's an opportunity for change is the entertainment biz, and that story is being explored in a new show from LA Studios, the podcast production arm of KPCC. It's called Hollywood, The Sequel, and the first episode comes out tomorrow. It's hosted by The Frame's John Horn. Hello, John.
Hey, A.
Now, okay, John, the tagline for this new podcast is Hollywood is broken, let's fix it. So what's the podcast about?
Hollywood has shut down since March, not only in production, but in terms of distribution, in terms of everything that's happening now. So since the town is on pause, the question that a lot of people are asking, and I think we're echoing this question, is since it stopped, how does it restart And should it restart the same way that it was before the pandemic, or is this really an opportunity to change things? And not just change things in terms of how movies are distributed, are they going to go on video on demand versus in theaters, but systemic changes. How can the business be kind of reinvented if you have an opportunity to do so? So that's kind of the genesis of the podcast, and I think it's behind a lot of the questions that we are asking our guests.
Yeah, and that actually answers my next question, because I was going to ask you, why do this now? But that's exactly the reason. We're in a weird kind of time right now. This is the perfect time to ask that question.
It is. And I think the question is, you know, what's going to happen? So everybody is saying there are certain models that no longer work. And maybe people go back to theaters. Maybe there's going to be a time where you can have 100 people on a movie set. Those are questions that we're going to address. But the more fundamental question is, what is going to be the priority going forward? Is it going to be stories that are told from a very narrow point of view? I mean, there have been study after study after study about who gets to tell stories. Very few female directors get to direct. Very few people of color get to star in movies. So if Hollywood is actually going to step back and look at itself and say, we can do things differently, what does that mean? And what has to be in place to bring about that kind of change?
Are those some of the ways that your guests are telling you about how Hollywood is broken?
Yeah, and there's certainly different perspectives on what needs to be done. We talked recently with Ava DuVernay. You probably know her from Selma, 13th, When They See Us. And what she said basically is that two things have to happen. First of all, because the studios aren't doing it, there has to be somebody who is producing content that is necessary. So she started a program called the Law Enforcement Accountability Project, which is funding things like films, documentaries, theater pieces that are holding the police accountable through narrative storytelling. The other thing that she says is, just like the police, there has to be a fundamental restructuring of how Hollywood is run. She says this has been a system that has been in place for more than a century. It is flawed in terms of who gets to decide what gets made. And she basically says you got to start from scratch. Other people think there are ways to work within the existing framework to bring about change. Ava has a more radical idea, which is basically, you know, tear it all down and start to rebuild from the studs.
Now, your first episode is with Kerry Washington. Let's play a clip that you brought from that interview.
I'm really proud to work in a medium that can help to transform people's ideologies and hearts and consciousness. But I'm also proud to be doing work to help shift institutional practices, because it's going to take both approaches for us to live in a world where equality is not just a dream.
Now, Kerry Washington is a really fascinating first guest because obviously a performer known for Scandal and other movies, but she's also a producer and an activist. What does she tell you that needs to be done to achieve equality for real in Hollywood?
Well, she has a good example, and that is that she produced a documentary called The Fight, and it's about ACLU lawyers who are fighting the Trump administration, basically protecting those who are most vulnerable. They could be immigrants, they could be people held in custody, they could be LGBTQ people. So the idea of the documentary is like, here are some people who are fighting on behalf of those who need protection. And Kerry's idea is to take that idea of people who are fighting for the less fortunate, those at risk, and apply it to Hollywood, that it's not just good enough to say for the business to be not racist, but it has to be actively anti-racist and involved as an agent of change. And that could be the kinds of stories that it tells. It could be the kinds of things that Kerry as an actor wants to be in, how she uses her clout as a producer to make stories that she thinks can bring about real change. Because there are a lot of stories and studies that suggest that narrative storytelling can be more impactful than, say, you know, a magazine article or a book, that people can envision a different future if they're presented it in a fictional way. So I think that's what Kerry and a lot of other storytellers are imagining, that there's a real way to choose stories that can bring about some sort of equality, not just in practical life, but in the way we think and the way we see the world.
Started John Horn, host of the new LA Studios podcast, Hollywood, the Sequel. Now, the pandemic is still with us, not going away anytime soon, but production in some ways is actually starting up again. What are your guests telling you about how or if they would feel comfortable about going back to work, going back on a set?
How about not? Yeah. I think that would be the more accurate answer. I mean, there have been a number of decisions on the state and local level about when and if production can resume. And essentially, the state and LA County is saying you can start back now. And a lot of people I've talked to, and that this isn't just actors, but it's directors, it's producers, say it's not safe yet. And I think you know from all the reporting that we've been doing on the station, we're just as dangerous now as we were, you know, a couple months ago. So the idea that things are suddenly safer, I think, is a fantasy. And I think the way that movies are made with so many people in close proximity to one another is still especially dangerous. I saw an actor over the weekend I just ran into. He goes, "I'm not going back to work anytime soon." So I think even though you might be able to, I think most filmmakers and actors are hesitant to do so because it feels dangerous. And I think the same is going to be true with movie theaters that are starting to open over the next couple of weeks. We have live action Mulan coming out and then Christopher Nolan's movie that called Tenet coming out. I'm excited to see those movies. The question is, how many people will be willing to go into a movie theater and check them out?
John, you know me. I go to many, many movies a month, and I'm not going to go. Not yet. No way. Not for a good long time. And definitely not a movie that is one that might have a lot of people in the theater. I know they're going to limit the amount of people in that theater, but I would even wait a few weeks or months before I go back into a theater to give it some kind of some distance.
No, I think a lot of people agree with you. And the other question is not just being in the auditorium, it's going to the concession stand, mm-hmm. it's walking into the theater. How do you get distance from those people? And you might be able to sit with your family, but you know, a lot of movies have three-year-old kids in them. They're not maybe going to be wearing their mask or observing social distance rules. I think it's going to be really tricky.
Now, while we have you here, I did want to ask about a non-Hollywood topic. You had a conversation today with LACMA CEO Michael Govan about the fact that the museum got a PPP loan from Washington. What did he tell you about that?
Well, he said something that is really remarkable, and that is that LACMA is not going to lay off or furlough any of its staff, which is unbelievable. They have almost 500 employees. They got $6.7 million from the federal government through the PPP loan. That loan runs out, as most of these loans do, at the end of the month. But once the loan is over, some organizations have the ability to start furloughing or laying off staff. LACMA is looking at a mid-July opening of some of its campus. They're going to have some rules in place in terms of the way that traffic flows through galleries, timed admissions, touchless, you know, kiosks and restroom doors and things like that. But the fact that they did not lose any staff, I mean, they have a board that gave a lot of money. They're in the middle of a huge building project. They say that they are able through this loan to keep people on staff so that they can plan for a future that is going to be almost fully operational coming soon within limitations about social distancing. But the fact that LACMA is not going to lose any staff, I think, is stunning because so many peer arts organizations are going through massive layoffs. Smaller museums and galleries have had to lay off, you know, 75% of their staff. Center Theater Group says it's not going to open till April. That LACMA could be opening in a couple of weeks is really stunning.
John Horn is host of the new LA Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. It comes out tomorrow with an interview with Kerry Washington, and you get the podcast wherever you download your podcast. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, depending on who you ask, police reform can happen any number of ways. You've heard defund the police. You've heard dissolve the police. Accountability is also mentioned, but it's pretty much useless if consequences do not immediately follow. Coming up, we'll continue our series on reforming the Los Angeles Police Department, where we're going to hear about one perspective that says, yes, the community definitely wants police, but wants police that are held accountable with those consequences. If not, then there might not even have to be one. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. The LA City Council has been holding one meeting after another to discuss the Los Angeles Police Department, its response to the continuous protests against police violence in communities of colors. The council has largely been focused on city finances and how much of the LAPD's budget should be redirected to other community-based programs. Today on the show, we continue our series of conversations with various experts about how they would reform the department. And joining us is Georgia Leap, director of the Social Justice Research Partnership at UCLA, where she specializes in gang intervention and communities. Georgia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, as part of your ongoing work, you happened to be in Watts last week talking to the community, and the issue of police and reform came up. What are some of the things you heard that people want from the LAPD?
The people I spoke to who live in the Watts community were very clear that they want law enforcement there. They are not interested in any kind of disappearance or abolition of the police, but they don't want law enforcement there with a heavy hand. And they were especially adamant that when there is use of force or when there is abuse or when there is brutality or sadly, when there is death, they want there to be repercussions.
Accountability. That's what they want too. Accountability.
You know, I think too often we say accountability. I think what they want is accountability with consequences. Mm. Or as one resident said to me, and these were exactly his words, we never see repercussions. That's the problem in a nutshell. If the community feels they never or they rarely see repercussions, we have a problem.
Okay, so if people there still want a police force, but a different kind of police force, then let's talk about your top three recommendations on how the LAPD can get there. Now, your first follows what Black Lives Matter has been working on, and that's defunding the police. Can you explain what you mean when you say defund the police?
In a certain way, those are extremely effective, but they're also electroshock words. And what we're talking about, or what I am talking about, is the idea of funds and functions being transferred to other departments, other people, other professionals that the police don't want responsibility for and that are better served by other professionals. Professional social workers, mental health professionals, public health professionals. These are the individuals who are well qualified to respond to crises, to emergencies that don't involve violent or lethal behavior. And everybody's lined up on my first idea. It's not original. It's not a standalone. Even the police, the LA Police Protective League endorsed this idea.
And that's the union that represents the LAPD.
That's the union that represents the rank and file. It is the police officers who are in the field, the men and women who are in our communities.
Now, next on your list of reforms is no reform. Instead, you propose that the LAPD completely transform its mission. How so, Georgia?
I think we've got to stop using the word reform. I think reform has been a failure. I think there's got to be a transformation. We have to radically change the culture of policing. And the model that I advocate is one that I did research on, which is something called the Community Safety Partnership.
How would it change how people see the police? How would that change?
Because it is a community safety partnership, and that word partnership should be in bold. The police officers that are signed up for the Community Safety Partnership are specially selected, and they are trained, and they have to sign up for a 5-year term. The first thing that CSP officers must do when they enter a community is a practice entitled Truth and Reconciliation. And it consists of the officers apologizing sincerely, not lip service, but sincerely for the past abuses and trauma. And by the way, oftentimes they stumble. Residents have said to CSP officers, you weren't even alive when the Watts riots happened. You weren't even alive during Rodney King, which it's now that long ago. And officers have said, yes, I was a little kid growing up during Rodney King, but I remember, and the LAPD was wrong in what they did. The partnership is just that. Anyone who's been in a relationship, whether personal or professional, knows there's tremendous give and take. And that's integral to relationship-based policing.
But George, I want to ask you, though, because when the word community and police are thrown around together, we've heard from guests about community policing. How would this be different?
It's completely different. When we look at how the LAPD practiced community policing in past years, what they did was they would have town halls and community meetings, and they had community advisory boards, and they would sit down with these groups and they would say, what are the problems you are concerned with in your community? And the groups might say gangs, or the groups might say burglaries. And the LAPD officers and leaders would take notes and say, okay, these are the particular problems in the community. And then they would go away, figure out a strategy, and quote unquote, solve the problem. That is a group of warriors making a list and then figuring out what, in their opinion, is the best way to solve the problem. It's not a partnership.
Talking to Georgia Leap, Director of the Social Justice Research Partnership at UCLA. Now, Georgia, finally, your last recommendation is more accountability for officer misconduct. But how would you do it?
Accountability is not enough. As I was told by the residents in Watts, and as Father Greg Boyle, the founder and leader of Homeboy Industries, said to me recently, people in Boyle Heights, as well as the people I know in Watts, they want the police in their communities, but they want a different culture of policing. And as the one resident in Watts said to me, they want there to be consequences for bad or brutal behavior. You know, I hearken back to what's called the Christopher Commission that was formed after the horrible incident involving the beating of Rodney King and what ensued afterwards. And the Christopher Commission found that there were over 2,000 allegations of excessive force from 1986 to 1990. Only 42 were sustained. That means that less than 2% of those allegations were sustained in terms of excessive force. Now, in case anyone says that's ancient history, all we have to do is look at the recent record of Derek Chauvin. He's the police officer who was charged with the murder of George Floyd. What we learned about Derek Chauvin is that in his 19 years as a police officer, there were 17 complaints about him, and only for one did he receive disciplinary action. Where are the consequences? Where are the repercussions? I'm going to borrow from a criminal justice policy I don't particularly like, but we talk a lot about three strikes as a form of punishment. Quite candidly, where are the three strikes for police officers? What number is too many to enable an individual to continue in their position?
But wouldn't all that you're talking about, Georgia, have to somehow be collectively bargained? Police unions are not only just powerful, but many politicians are afraid to do anything that would upset them.
There's got to be a politician who looks at the will of the people and understands that what we have is not a moment, it's a movement. Yes, the police unions are powerful, but I now think we have activists and organizers and citizens who are equally powerful. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon them to lean upon the politicians. And I think we have got to have some politicians who develop courage and the political will to stand against this.
Now, thinking back, Georgia, to your work in communities such as Watts, I'm wondering, if with its history, is the damage done? I mean, can the people there really find ways to trust police officers in the wake of high-profile cases of abuse and misconduct?
I'm an eternal optimist, and I've seen things in Watts and listened to people. I think one of the most stunning examples of this is the Watts Gang Task Force, which was originally organized to deal with the epidemic level of gang violence and gang crime in Watts. And when you look at who is on the board, consists of people from the community, leaders from the community. These are individuals who, some of them were arrested and fought with the police. You go to the Watts Gang Task Force and you will see members of a community long brutalized by the LAPD meeting together in partnership, trying to solve problems with law enforcement. Now, don't make a mistake about it. It's not a routine love fest. But in the end, they gather together because they are fighting together on problems within the community. With the emergence of relationship-based policing, That is another strategy for ending the excessive use of force. And then we wouldn't even have to fight the police unions about what's going on.
That's Georgia Leib, director of the Social Justice Research Partnership at UCLA, where she specializes in gang intervention and communities. Georgia, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
All right, moving on. Advocates have long said that the presence of police on school campuses could negatively affect the learning environment. Now, they're renewing their calls to remove these officers. And as KPECC's Carla Javier reports, this time administrators are paying more attention.
Hundreds marched to the Los Angeles Unified headquarters with one specific demand. One of them was Maya Edwards, a recent graduate of Venice High School, an organizer with Students Deserve.
We show up to our schools and walk around communities feeling we are the threats, that we are the reason why the school police are standing in the hallways breathing down our necks.
Researchers say that feeling Edwards is describing can affect the school climate and learning.
When kids are under stress, they don't perform as well.
That's Pedro Noguera, the incoming dean of the USC Rossier School of Education.
When kids are taken out of the classroom to be punished or to be processed in some way, they're not in school learning.
He says in order to learn, kids need to feel safe and supported, and presence of police in school could detract from that. UCLA Assistant Professor Emily Weisburst found some evidence of the effect of police in schools while she was doing graduate research in Texas.
Funding for police or police presence can be associated with the daily workings of a high school, including things like low-level disciplinary actions, and those actually can add up to potentially have longer-term negative outcomes for students.
Including small but significant decreases in graduation and college enrollment rates. Research into the effect of school police on students and calls by advocates to reduce or remove officers from campus aren't entirely new, but the social movements surrounding police violence and racism have drawn renewed attention to the issue.
I think the public is more receptive to truths that, you know, advocates have been speaking for so long, but it's just undeniable in the wake of what's happened recently.
That's ACLU of Southern California policy attorney Amir Whitaker. He's worked on campaigns and studies looking at the number of schools around the state and country that have cops but don't have counselors, and what effect those choices have on Black and vulnerable students.
Positions and supports for students that we've envisioned in a traditional school have been sacrificed at the expense of police.
Which is why when protesters demand districts defund school police, they're also calling for the money to be reallocated to mental health support and counselors. The leadership of United Teachers Los Angeles, the union representing LAUSD teachers, has come out in favor of eliminating the $70 million school police budget. The vice president of the Los Angeles School Police Association, William Itu, says criticisms of school police don't reflect his 15 years with the department.
My experience is that kids really have a great relationship with us.
School police and their supporters say they aren't like other cops, that they're trained to get to know, work with, and protect young people, even if that might not be obvious at first glance, since LA school police have blue uniforms that look a lot like LAPD's.
We've also considered uniform changes.
So khakis and polos.
And other things to make, you know, us more approachable to students.
Other changes on the table include hiring officers who haven't served in other law enforcement agencies, getting rid of pepper spray and a controversial restraining maneuver called the carotid hold, creating focus groups, and moving school police to the perimeter of schools. But advocates like Whitaker question if reforms go far enough.
Even in LAUSD, where they say, oh, well, officers have special training, you know, it's like putting a pillow in front of a hammer. It's still a hammer, right?
The Los Angeles Unified School Board will consider three resolutions, including one to reduce funding for the school police department at its regular meeting on Tuesday. I'm Carla Javier.
And KPECC's Chava Sanchez contributed reporting to that story. If you have an experience with school police that you'd like to share with us, you can reach out on our website. That's LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. All right, I mentioned last week that California is starting to feel a little like a scene out of The Karate Kid. Mask on, mask off, and now masks all the way back on again. That with Governor Newsom's new face covering mandate. Now, Orange County has been an area of resistance to Sacramento and Governor Newsom's mandates the past few months as it relates to stay-at-home orders, also opening or closing of beaches, and wearing masks. Coming up, we'll hear how it's going in Orange County as coronavirus numbers there continue to climb. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Coronavirus-related hospitalizations and deaths in Orange County have been on the rise in recent weeks. Rates have now surpassed those in neighboring counties, presenting a major hurdle to local health officials. Let's get our weekly OC update from Nick Gerda. He's a reporter for Voice of OC. Nick, welcome back.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks,
Nick. Right. Sure. And okay, now this marks a real change in direction for Orange County, Nick. Since the pandemic took hold in mid-March, hospitalizations and deaths related to COVID-19 were lower than surrounding counties. So what is the coronavirus picture in Orange County like right now, and how did things get to where they are right now?
Yeah, so back in April, Orange County was better than all four of the surrounding counties when it comes to hospitalization and death rates from coronavirus on a per resident basis. But OC's rates have been rising faster than the neighbors, and it's now overtaken three out of the four surrounding counties. Orange County has been consistently higher in its rates than San Diego, Riverside, and San Bernardino counties in recent days. And on one metric, OC has surpassed all four counties, including LA County, and that's the per capita rate of ICU and intensive care patients with coronavirus. In terms of human lives, 92 people have died in Orange County from COVID in the last 2 weeks, according to the official statistics, and about 360 people in Orange County hospitals currently. We asked county officials about Orange County's faster rise, and they linked it to the reopening of the local economy and said they did expect to see a rise when they moved to reopen a few weeks ago, that there's significant hospital capacity remaining for additional patients. And some county officials have also cited transfers in of COVID patients from other counties like Imperial County. But as of last week, that accounted for less than 10% of the coronavirus patients in OC. So that the other counties transferring in component appears to be a small portion of OC's increase in hospitalizations. The big message from public health officials about this increase has been that the public should wear masks and social distance as much as possible when going to businesses and out and about with people not in the same household to help limit the virus's spread. And businesses leaders in particular have been concerned that if the pace of hospitalizations and deaths continues to rise, that there could be a snapping back of restrictions on the economy. So they're really urging people to wear masks and practice physical distancing as much as possible when they're out and about.
Yeah, no one wants to have that happen. Nick, where are you seeing some of the biggest spikes? What kind of places?
Yeah, so like many communities across the region and really the country, nursing homes have been hit especially hard in Orange County. There's been over 1,000 confirmed infections among nursing home residents in OC and about 130 confirmed deaths among nursing home residents. That's about half of the total deaths in Orange County. And it's been a really sad situation for many families and people in the community. County health officials have noted there's a higher risk of outbreaks in these kinds of congregate living facilities like nursing homes, jails, and homeless shelters. And as outbreaks hit the residents there, staff have also been getting infected and are at risk of unintentionally spreading COVID to family members.
Now, Los Alamitos and Santa Ana seem to be getting hit particularly hard. It's home to 20% of the county's population, but also 40% of county residents who have tested positive for coronavirus. Why is it so bad in those two places?
Exactly. So it's Anaheim and Santa Ana. They are really getting hit much worse than most of the other cities in Orange County. Researchers have been looking at this, and they're saying that the worst hit communities and zip codes tend to have lower incomes and higher rates of people working in those frontline essential jobs that require interfacing in person with the public, like grocery store workers. And researchers are finding that overcrowded housing also is a risk factor for coronavirus spreading faster in a community. So there's really a disproportionate impact on these low-income communities of color, particularly Santa Ana and West Anaheim. Some examples: Santa Ana's infection rate per resident is over 5 times higher than Irvine's and 7 times higher than Laguna Niguel. Anaheim is about 6 times higher than Aliso Viejo and Laguna Niguel. So researchers are noting that many residents in these communities are likely getting infected at workplaces elsewhere in the county. So it's really these frontline workers who are disproportionately affected. We had to crunch those numbers ourselves to calculate the infection rates based on the official data. Because the county doesn't post the rates on its website, they post the raw number of confirmed infections by city and the population. So when you do the math, you can calculate the rate, and that's how you could do a meaningful comparison of how the cities are affected.
All right, sorry about that, Nick. I pushed the wrong button. No one should let me, the host, push any buttons here. Now, you mentioned how it was expected. Cases were expected to rise as businesses reopen. And I know that Orange County Health Care Agency, the director, Clayton Chow, said they've asked the community to maintain distancing, wearing masks. But that has been a hot button issue in Orange County. I know that because we've seen different kinds of ways people have expressed their frustration with that on television and on the radio. Any thought, though, that county leaders could make a push to get people to wear masks?
Yeah, so their tune has been changing in recent days to be more supportive of masks as the supervisors face more and more calls from groups like the Children's Hospital of Orange County to really urge the public to wear face coverings. CHOC, as it's known, wrote a letter to the board of supervisors saying that they're very concerned that if the community continues to reject wearing face coverings, that you could see a spike in cases and hospitalizations even more and lead to more shutdowns and restrictions. So the key moment on all this will be tomorrow morning's supervisors meeting. It's going to be streamed live on the county's website, and the supervisors are scheduled to get an update about COVID in Orange County, and we'll see there what they have to say about masks.
One more thing, Nick, just about 30 seconds left. I know things are also being affected, like sales tax revenues and budget cuts, furloughs may come to some county departments. How big is the hole? Who might take that hit?
Yeah, so the county's looking at a big financial hit of over $200 million for key funding streams for social services and law enforcement. They've already deleted over 500 vacant jobs from the budget, putting together a plan on what to do. Some unknowns here on how much the economy bounces back and whether Congress helps bail out local governments. But they're starting to look at furloughs and potential cuts to these key social services and potentially law enforcement as well.
All right, Nick Gerter reports for The Voice of OC. Nick, as always, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to stay in Orange County as the happiest place on earth is just a few weeks away from opening up. No, not South Coast Plaza. That's open already. Disneyland. That's right. Disneyland. And if you think, considering what you just heard about coronavirus infection and death rates, that might be too soon. Well, that's actually one of the theme parks that is opening up later than some of the others. We'll get into all that coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Time. 'Cause when you shut the door.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Amy Martinez. The happiest place on earth plans to reopen its gates soon. Despite cases of COVID-19 increasing throughout the state, Disneyland is currently set to welcome guests again in just a few more weeks, July 17th. Now, if that's too soon for some of you, it's actually later than some other amusement parks in our area because pending state approval, both Universal Studios Hollywood and Six Flags Magic Mountain plan to reopen next week on July 1st. There are some hurdles, though, in the way. And with us now is Robert Niles, founder and editor of the site Theme Park Insider. Robert, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, Disney officials picked July 17th because that's the 65th anniversary of Disneyland opening for the first time. But late last week, unions representing many workers there got involved and hoped to slow down the process. What'd they do and why?
Well, basically, the unions are asking Governor Gavin Newsom to reconsider or actually not grant any permission yet for them to open because, again, that opening date is pending state approval and they haven't gotten it yet. So a lot of the unions they're concerned that they haven't gotten the full details of Disney's plan to reopen safely and protect those cast members. So they want to make sure that Disney doesn't get approval until they've got some reassurances that it's going to be safe for everyone involved once the parks reopen.
Robert, what do you know about what is being done to keep the park's cast members safe? I know Disneyland is kind of a compact theme park in the grander
Absolutely.
Scheme of theme parks.
Absolutely. This is the original theme park, really. It is small by comparison to Disney's other theme parks around the world. But as anyone who's visited there recently knows, they can pack people in there pretty tight. So what we know from what Disney's done in their parks in China that they've reopened and the parks that they're planning to reopen at Walt Disney World in Florida next month, a wide variety of health and safety procedures, temperature checks for everyone coming in. Everyone's got to wear masks. Wiping down surfaces, but the big thing is capacity control. You're going to have to make an advance reservation to get into the park, and they're only going to be taking a small percentage of the people that they would normally be admitting to the park on a busy summer day.
Now, the reservation system, I know that they were thinking about trying it when eventually the location in Florida does open. How is that supposed to work?
That actually opened today for Walt Disney World Resort hotel guests. They got the first crack at the system, and they pretty much just brought the thing down this morning at 7 a.m. Eastern time when it opened. Tons of people trying to get in and make their reservations. But these were just people who already had confirmed hotel reservations and tickets for the parks. So a lot of them have had vacations that they've been postponing that have been canceled that they had been planning to take earlier this year. The annual pass holders will get a chance in a few days, and then eventually, you know, just day trippers, people with regular day tickets will be able to get in. But the system, it kind of works like if anybody has the Disney Flex Pass at Disneyland that they started selling last year. It's kind of the same concept. You just pick a day that you want to come into the park, and if it's available, you do it through the app or online, and you've got the reservation.
Has it been smooth today, or it's just kind of been a mess?
I mean, it was kind of a mess at the beginning, but things got straightened out as the load. They balanced the load, put a few more hamsters on the wheel at the servers, and
those hamsters better not be union employees, Robert.
They feed them. Chip and Dale, they've got a side gig now. They've got the whole thing working up, and people are getting their reservations now. So it'll be okay.
Anything else maybe to learn from Disney World in Florida since they are starting to take those reservations for guests?
Well, the big thing at this point is everyone is just kind of concerned about how much people are going to want to visit. I mean, there are a lot of people here right now that had planned visits, so they're just kind of working through all of those cancellations and postponements. But without international travel, without people doing a lot of interstate travel, people are wondering how much demand is there going to be for Disney World vacations once they get through this backlog of people who had already scheduled to come. And then how does that apply to California, where the visitors are much more locals than they are for Walt Disney World in Florida? It's vast majority of people go to Disneyland are locals on annual passes. How's that going to work out here? We don't know yet.
Talking to Robert Niles, founder and editor of the site Theme Park Insider. You mentioned how Disneyland is more of a place for locals. It is in Orange County. Last week, there were some fireworks over wearing masks. First, county officials rescinded the order that people wear masks when in close contact with others. And Governor Newsom issued a mandatory order for face coverings, overriding Orange County. Robert, what does this back and forth mean for people who plan to go to Disneyland as soon as it opens up?
Well, Disney said since the very beginning of this whole crisis that when they reopened that they were going to require masks from everyone. But having worked in theme parks before, I know it's a lot easier to get people to comply with something if you've got, you know, state law enforcement backing you up. So while Disney was always going to require masks, I think it's going to be a little bit easier to enforce if they can point to Governor Newsom's order and say, hey, you know, don't blame. I mean, you might not like what I'm telling you, but this is the governor talking. And if you want to take it up with him, go ahead. But for now, you're wearing a mask.
Now, Robert, meanwhile, other major parks in L.A., Six Flags, Universal Studios, they hope to reopen next week. They got to get approval, as you mentioned, from the state, as all theme parks do. But first, what can you tell us about how the park experience might be different in both of those places?
I think it's going to be very similar to what we've talked about with Disney. This is really becoming the emerging industry standard, that there's limited capacity. You may or may not have to make a reservation, but they're not going to be just letting everyone in the door. If they've got too many people in the park to maintain social distancing, they're going to close the gates. The people are going to be wearing masks, that there's going to be limited capacity on rides and shows, you know, every other row, space in between you. No more keep up with the party in front of you. It's, you know, 6 feet of distance between everybody in the queues. A lot of mobile ordering, wiping down stuff constantly, a lot of hand sanitizer. Yeah. It's just a lot of the same things that we're seeing in a lot of businesses around the state of California. We're going to be seeing in theme parks as well, just on a much larger scale.
One more thing, Robert, really quick, about 30 seconds. I know, you know, people want to get back to normal. Would you be willing to go back to a theme park anytime soon? I mean, you're the expert. You're the founder and editor of Theme Park Insider. What would it take?
It's my job to cover theme parks. Yeah. So there. But I mean, I'll tell you what. I mean, I'm going to make sure that I've got a mask with, you know, not just a flimsy face coloring, but something with a filter on it that's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be, you know, washing my hands and paying attention and doing exactly what they tell me to do to try and keep me safe and the people around me safe as well, because I mean, wearing that mask to protect other people as well. And that's very important.
If you go, Robert, come back. Tell us how it went. That's Robert Niles, absolutely, founder and editor of the site Theme Park Insider. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. If you missed any part of the show today, it was a really, really good one, so just go wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be, waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. We're on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me there as well, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. And I always preview the show every day before the show, so make sure you follow me on Twitter to find out what's coming up on Take Two. That's at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.